In his new book, The Age of Clinton, America in the 1990s, historian Gil Troy asks us to look past our prejudices about William Jefferson Clinton's presidency and instead focus on the ways in which his time in office shaped the culture of the 1990s. The book also, of course, sheds light on Hillary Clinton's political career as we approach the 2016 election. Gil Troy is a professor of history at McGill University, and again, the new book is The Age of Clinton. Thank you very much for being with us, Gil Troy.
Great to be with you.
Very nice to have you with us. What brought you to the subject of wanting to look at this idea of the culture of Clinton?
I wrote a book a couple of years ago about Ronald Reagan called Morning in America, about the 1980s and American culture. And I think there are certain presidents, Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s, Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and now I'd argue Bill Clinton in the 1990s, who so dominated the times, they weren't just politically important, but they were also culturally important. And to truly understand the Roosevelt era, the Reagan era, and now I'm arguing the Clinton era, to take it seriously, and that's what the book is trying to do, you need to understand all the cultural changes, the technological changes, the economic changes that are going on. The other part of it is that growing up as a kid, I loved those decades books. I loved Frederick Lewis Allen's Only Yesterday about the 20s. I loved reading about the 50s. I loved going into a profession where if you're writing about the 1950s, I Love Lucy could be an important historical event. And so I wanted to take the decades books and the presidency books and put them together.
Do we have a good sense yet of what that Clinton era is? In other words, has enough time gone by?
This is one of the challenges of being a contemporary historian. When I was in Moscow many years ago and I said I was an American historian, they said, oh, Moscow is history of 950 years. And they said all of American history is current events. And it's a challenge when you're certainly doing something in the 1990s. And yeah, you did mention there was this rumor that Hillary Clinton was running, and that was kind of, you know, looming large too. So obviously it's information, but I think it's important for historians to start looking at things, and I think it's important for historians to start shaping the conversation. I don't, when a president is in office, respond to those quickie polls saying, is he the worst president ever? Is he the best president ever? I think then it's too early, and we're not journalists. It's not our job to kind of go for that instant history, although I do try to write commentary about what's going on and put it in historical perspective. But now we're coming up to almost a quarter of a century since Bill Clinton ran for office, and I think it's time to start saying what are some of the changes that he implemented, what are some of the successes he had, what are some of the failures, and you can start seeing contours, and things change. I mean, my perception of things that I saw in the 1990s and was writing in real time and my perception now as a historian have evolved.
You write in the book, and I think it's fascinating because you talk about this very upfront about being a complicated legacy. And I ask the question of the legacies that you mentioned prior, are all legacies complicated or is this one especially complicated?
Yes and yes. Look, you know, I'm sitting here in Washington and Washington has become a town where you have to simplify. So either you write a book about Bill Clinton about how great he is, the greatest thing since sliced bread, or the worst thing since the latest war. And that's not healthy, and that's not helpful. It's not healthy for a democracy, it's not healthy for a political system, and it's certainly not healthy for a historian. So yes, historians are in the business of showing complexity. The historians are in the business of saying we're not just going to make them into superheroes, we're going to look at them as human beings with strengths and weaknesses. But when you talk about Bill Clinton and the 1990s, you're talking about a particularly complicated legacy because Bill Clinton had this extraordinary talent. He had this extraordinary vision. He understood what was going on in America in terms of the fundamental changes technologically, economically, culturally, in a way that few did. But he also had this extraordinary ability to get into trouble. He had a great ability to survive that trouble, but that constant up and down makes it what I call a manic depressive presidency. We're constantly, and with the highest of highs and the lowest of lows, with an incredibly talented person who just didn't truly fulfill his potential because he had these moral blind spots and he had these psychological issues, I think maybe, that ultimately led him into big messes.
Of course, he's coming into office after 8 years of President Reagan, 4 years of President Bush. So what is he walking into after 12 years of a Republican presidency and ran on one word, and that was hope? And how realistic was it to think that that was possible?
He runs on a lot of anger. He runs, indeed, after 12 years of Reagan and Bush, and he feels that it's become a culture of selfishness. It's become a culture where money is too important. It's become a culture of hyper-individualism. But he also has learned from Ronald Reagan in particular. He's also learned that there are certain problems within the Great Society that Democrats weren't willing to face. He's also learned that liberalism itself, if it isn't a little bit Reaganized, if it doesn't go a little bit centrist, it's not going to work. So yes, it's a campaign in 1992 fueled on hope, but it's also fueled, and this is one of my great insights that I had kind of an aha moment when I started reading his letters and articles and speeches from the 1980s and the early 90s before he's running, he had a take. He had a take as a Southern Democrat, as more of a centrist Democrat, trying to revive liberalism that he kept on coming back to. I want to be a liberal. I want to have a government that's effective, but I also want to fight crime. And in fact, he understands as a liberal that if you can't control the basic streets of America, if you can't give Americans a basic sense of safety, you can't go on and have any kind of faith in government. He says, I want to end welfare as we know it. And again, at critical moments in his presidency, he doesn't just turn to the polls, but he also turns to this clear vision. And I think that's one of the things that helps us understand Bill Clinton in historical perspective.
You talk in the book about how ideological a president he was, which may surprise many because of the focus more on his personal life.
Absolutely. I mischievously call him the most ideological president since Ronald Reagan. And that's because I did believe that he had this core values and this core vision that he kept on returning to. And just like Ronald Reagan didn't always fulfill his conservative ideology. In fact, he had these things called revenue enhancements, which other people would call taxes. He had deviations from his plan. And in fact, all he did is really succeed in slowing the rate of governmental growth, not really shrinking government. So too, Bill Clinton had deviations from his plan, didn't always follow through, but he had a certain vision. And indeed, as you point out, one of the dangers of just looking at it through the lens of the headlines, just looking at the Clinton presidency through the day-to-day, is you get sucked into all the personal problems, the scandals, the personal life, the Monica Lewinsky stuff in 1998, and you forget policies are being made, changes are occurring, and Bill Clinton is having a historical impact both on the American conversation and Americans' understanding of themselves, and also on what's happening on the ground in America.
And yet he was still very much unliked by many Republicans and many on the right far before Monica Lewinsky and other scandals. What was it about him, and you do talk about this in some depth, of what was it about him that was so repulsive to the right, other than the fact that he was a baby boomer?
Well, the baby boomer thing is definitely a part of it. He comes in representing that generation and representing the left of that generation and representing cultural change. And it hurts him in two ways. One is that many people on the right simply can't abide by it, can't abide by his lifestyle, by his past, having supported George McGovern, having never inhaled, but certainly been a little bit on the outskirts of the drug, sex, and rock and roll culture. And so that is one piece of it. The second piece of it is that as a baby boomer who understands that Americans are going through all kinds of changes. He says Americans feel like they're living in a funhouse, that they just, you know, things are good, but they also are unnerved by change. He, in some ways, as an exemplar of that change, becomes tagged with that change. And many people's anxiety about the changing cultural mores, about what I call a greater liquidity in the society, where everything's up for grabs and you kind of have a sense of social vertigo, you've lost your grounding, gets tagged on him and becomes a burden for him. There's also the fact that there's an interesting phenomenon where Woodrow Wilson, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton, all three of whom were more centrists and took certain ideas from the rival party. So they should have been incredibly popular with their rivals, with the opposition. And in fact, it gave the opposition a kind of huge headache. And it was almost, to take a Harry Potter image from the 1990s, like Bill Clinton was a Dementor who was stealing the souls of the Republican Party. And so even though you could say, well, look, he's a Democrat who's fighting crime. He's trying to end welfare, he knows it. He wants to balance the budget. Republicans should make him their favorite Democrat. In fact, that actually feeds a sense of he's dishonest. He's trying to steal our programs. He's trying to steal our souls. And he's a loose, libertine, hippie baby boomer to boot.
Weeks after his election, he immediately gets mired into the gays and the military debate. I remember sitting in a room with the late Molly Ivins and her looking at me and saying, I hope he knows what he's doing. Did he know what he was doing?
At that moment, he didn't. He was actually being very sincere. He had come in as, in many ways, the most gay-friendly president ever. He was friends with gays. He had important gay fundraisers. He went out to centers of gay life and spoke about the importance of treating them equally. And when asked kind of on the fly, just days after the election, with kind of the surge of enthusiasm and the great feeling of power that he, this baby boomer, this kid from Hope, Arkansas, is going to become president of the United States, is asked by Andrea Mitchell of NBC News, well, what about gays in the military? He stupidly, foolishly, but kind of sincerely and lovely, in a lovely way, says, we're gonna bring them into the military. And there it goes. The first couple of weeks of his administration are focused on that. The transition ends up being too focused on that. And it becomes a huge issue, and it becomes a huge distraction, such that when the Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin, has his first meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they don't talk about the Soviet Union, which was still around, crumbling, but still there and an issue. They don't talk about Bosnia, which is emerging as an issue. They don't talk about Somalia. They talk about gays in the military. In the last 5 minutes, they do a little bit on the state of the world.
And you also point this out, and I think it's interesting, is that the whole idea of don't ask, don't tell was not only the result of the gays in the military issue, but was almost a mantra of negative barbs at the administration of, well, we didn't ask you, and we're not going to tell you.
It's a problematic policy. So that's kind of the way he gets out of it. He says we're going to have a don't ask, don't tell policy where we're not going to acknowledge gays in the military, but we're also not going to hunt them down. And it's problematic both to the left and to the right. To the left, it's saying you're keeping us in the closet. You're keeping gays in the closet. You're making us invisible. And to the right and to the military, which is an institution based on honor, it's saying you're asking people to be dishonorable. You're asking people to be secretive. You're asking people to lie. So it was kind of a lose-lose policy. And that's the danger of being a centrist. I think it's very important that we have centrists in modern American politics. I think it's very important we have centrists in healthy democracies. But sometimes when you put a finger to the wind and you triangulate too much, rather than having a happy compromise where each side feels, I got something, and so I'm going to pull back, in this case, both sides were deeply alienated, and it just got worse and worse.
How much of the Bill Clinton story is timing, in the sense of, I mean, obviously there were the economic successes, but also there was the great innovation of the internet, the rise of the internet, and that coming into great favor, and obviously the money that was made in that time as well. Are we to look at him and say he is responsible for a portion of that? Or do we look at him and say he was very lucky to come in at that particular time?
Very important question. And in some ways, the answer is yes. We have a tendency to attribute to presidents a kind of magical quality that as soon as they come in and become in charge, if there's a boom, it's their boom. If there's a bust, it's their bust. We don't acknowledge the fact that things build and that, for example, the Budget Balancing Act that George H.W. Bush signed, where he raised new taxes and he broke that pledge of read my lips, no new taxes, in fact, helped establish the basis for the prosperity of the 1990s. So Bill Clinton has to thank George H.W. Bush for the success of his presidency. We tend to look at it as just sort of boom, Clinton started, and there it's going. So yes, luck was a dimension to it. America was ready to boom. The technological innovations you're talking about are extraordinary. But he also understood how to use those technology innovations. He understood how to make sure that the United States would not be what he called an internet have, an internet have-not country. He made sure, there's a wonderful picture I have in the book of Al Gore and Bill Clinton in shirt sleeves, not with jackets and ties, in California, just running a cable through a school because they wanted to make sure that every school would be hooked up to this great American invention called the internet. And then you see where luck, so you have the luck, you have the taking advantage of the luck, and then luck kicks in again. So, for example, in the 1970s, when Richard Nixon runs into the Watergate scandal, every month that the Watergate scandal gets worse and worse, the stock market is getting worse and worse. When Bill Clinton runs into the Monica Lewinsky problem, which was of his own making, every month the stock market is getting better and better, and lo and behold, Richard Nixon didn't survive, Bill Clinton did. And that's why context counts. I call it the historian's favorite text, context.
He leaves a very popular president. And so the question has to be asked about what is to be made of the relationship that he has with Al Gore to further that legacy.
And the Clintonites were so frustrated because they wanted Al Gore to basically run for a third Clinton term. Clinton's extraordinarily popular, way more popular than Ronald Reagan, even though the image is Ronald Reagan was always the popular guy. And Al Gore, partially because of his disgust, really, at Bill Clinton's behavior during the Lewinsky scandal. And, of course, it's quite ironic that the Clintons are still married and the Gores aren't, but we'll put that aside for the psychotherapy session afterwards. Gore also has the sense, and I think it's a psychological sense that often happens with very talented vice presidents, of, I want my moment in the sun. So he runs much more independently of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is frustrated throughout the campaign, and Clintonites are frustrated throughout the campaign. And lo and behold, just 15 years ago, in November 2000, there's this deadlock. And we should point out that not only did Al Gore get more votes on that day, but also more Floridians woke up with an intention to vote for Al Gore that day. But indeed, partially because of the anomalies of that infamous butterfly ballot, but also because of certain things like Al Gore didn't even win Tennessee. He didn't have enough of a political backbone, enough of a political surge, enough of a connection to Bill Clinton that would have given him enough insulation when he ran into the problem in Florida. And as a result, George W. Bush became president instead of Al Gore. But it's always hard to say who won. But certainly the post-game analysis was that if Al Gore had been closer to Bill Clinton and allowed Bill Clinton to embrace him more and to campaign more, he wouldn't have had such a close election and ultimately not ended up as president.
So 15 years after the end of his term, what does that say about the ultimate legacy when you still have Hillary Clinton running for president and a giant question mark?
Bill Clinton was a phenomenon. He was one of the most, and is one of the most talented, naturally born politicians. He loves politics. He loves people. I speak to people who, like Barack Obama, Democrats who agree with his agenda, but just they feel like he doesn't love the job and he doesn't love being a politician. And to have that rare mix of politics and policy is quite unique. But we see that the 90s was this time of extraordinary prosperity. Peace seemed to be breaking out all over. And then the day after that horrific tragedy in New York on September 11th, 2001, everybody's saying, what did we do with that peace and prosperity? How come we didn't take advantage of it? How come we didn't find deeper lives of meaning? How come we didn't do more for the community? And that's the Clinton conundrum. On the one hand, he was so darn talented. He did so much. Americans had so much during that period, and yet they didn't do enough socially, communally. And it goes to a deeper issue that in the 1990s, with all the change, the hookup to the internet, the changes in family, the changes in relationships, the changes in ideology, Americans feel not just blessed, but they also feel kind of soulless. They feel lost. They feel anchorless. And I talk about how we once upon a time were a republic of something, and now, on the one hand, we're the republic of everything. We have so much. We're so welcoming, so pluralistic, so tolerant, so amazing. And we've also become the republic of nothing. We fear that we don't have anchors. We fear we don't have tradition. And we need to figure out a new way to be a republic of something with the republic of everything.
What do you see fundamental differences in Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton as far as is running? This is her second time running for president. And much as we were just talking about with Al Gore and running on that record, that's a slippery slope too, isn't it, of Hillary Clinton being too much identified with her husband?
Hillary Clinton is absolutely stuck with the Al Gore dilemma. On the one hand, she wants to ride the wave, the continuing love and affection people have for Bill Clinton, the nostalgia so many Americans now have for the 1990s as pre-Osama bin Laden and pre-crash, not acknowledging that some of the forces that led to those two disasters also were occurring in the 1990s. So that's all for the good, and part of the reason why Hillary Clinton is a household name because of her husband, Bill Clinton. Obviously, she built on it. But on the other hand, she keeps on running into Clinton fatigue. On the other hand, she keeps on running into Clinton baggage. On the other hand, she keeps on running into people feeling like, oh my goodness, first of all, are you going to update your vision? Are you going to update what's going on? And secondly, are you going to bring us back to all the worst of the 1990s? So it's a delicate dance. She, on the one hand, has to embrace his legacy because they're still married and she's a part of that legacy. And she also was the first lady who had a lot of influence in that 8-year administration. But on the other hand, she can't simply promise more of the same. And her problem, her challenge, is that she's also constantly being compared to this extraordinary political phenomenon, this unbelievable political talent. And she's extremely smart, but she doesn't have the same people smarts. In fact, when they met, Bill Clinton fell in love with her because he was the smartest. She was the smartest woman he'd ever met, and she fell in love with him. And this is by their own discussions. She fell in love with him because he had such a natural talent with people. She'd been called Sister Frigidaire in high school, which is a very mean nickname. But she liked that, and she liked that ability of his to kind of be so fluid and be so charming. And she needs that a massive infusion of that from him right now.
Gil Troy is a professor of history at McGill University and a visiting scholar in governance studies at the Brookings Institution this fall. The name of the book is The Age of Clinton, America in the 1990s. It is published by Thomas Dunn Books, St. Martin's Press. Gil Troy, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for those excellent questions.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Age of Clinton, America in the 1990s. Gil Troy is the author. St. Martin's Press is the publisher. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.